just repeat the title. It's Sangha and Radical Kinship. Yeah. And I just defined Sangha, but yeah. It look in the chat for the links, that'll help. So anyway, the reason I chose Sangha is because it's the topic that is alive for me right now. Because of what I'm doing. I'm going back to school. I'm going to the New York Zen Center online to study their contemplative care practice program, in their contemplative care practice program, and doing internship hours associated with that. And so I wanted to talk about that. And that's all about working with people. So so I wanted to open with this. Little imagery here. I thought of this description of Dogen that I had heard in his last days of attempting to get over his illness. He went to Kyoto, and he had a serious illness that he eventually passed away from. And there was a large wooden post in the room with one of those vertical scrolls on it, and the kanji said Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and he would circle the room. And he would place his hand on the scroll, right? Kind of touch it with his hand. And I envision that since it's kind of high, sort of big, and it's a Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and that was the one he touched because it was close. So the one thing about this story is that I remembered it. I wrote it down and then I tried to go back and find out where I had found it. And I couldn't. So I'm like, oh no, I hope I didn't dream it or make it up because I don't want to like be making up stuff. That's crazy town. I need to find out what's going on. So I talked to my mentor. We're all assigned mentors at the New York Zen Center program. Her name's Yoshin. And I asked her, where did I get this? Was this in class? And she goes, you know, part of a lecture. And she replied, I don't recall, but how beautiful that tale for now lives in the mystery. Oh, what a Zen answer. Thanks, Yoshin, for the not knowing answer. Awesome. Anyway, so like Tonya likes to say, whether it happened or not. I like imagining it because it kind of set me thinking about it, the three treasures being together, as Dogen liked to think of them as one thing, one absolute reality. We take refuge in these three all at once. And in a sense, when we do so, we're touching the scroll with our hand. The Sangha aspect is so important because the third treasure is how we connect to each other in the world. And without this connection, our practice wouldn't be this living, breathing thing it is. Koshin Paley Ellison, whose name I will say a lot, and I should probably just say KPE, it's kind of a mouthful. Good old Koshin. He said he's one of the co-founders of the New York Zen Center, and he's a teacher at the contemplative care class I'm in. He puts it like this. Sangha is the one that operationalizes the other two, putting Buddha and Dharma into action. So, first, I'm going to talk a little bit about Sangha in a really standard way, what a community is, what it looks like. Are all communities Sanghas? I don't know. I'm sort of thinking about that. It can look like this, which is definitely a Sangha. I think it can also look like finding support in close groups, like book clubs, maybe activist meetings for sure. I've had some activist experiences that have felt Sangha-y. And definitely like 12-step communities and such. Those are very Sangha-like. In recent months, I've been to the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is a women's prison, to assist in providing Buddhist services for the inmates there. And it is just to sort of ground you in what it looks like, what it feels like. It's a big room. It's called a chapel. It's not churchy, but it's painted with a lot of interesting things on the outside. You know, there's sort of trees and there's all these words for love in different languages, and it's got a kind of Unitarian chapel feel to it. And we're seated on zafus and zabutons, just as we do here, but the seating is a big circle and we all face each other. And then at one end of the circle is the, it's just on a small table, the altar. I would say the women there are definitely, well, because it's a Buddhist thing. Like they're their own sangha within the facility. And then they sort of have their own sanghas within nested communities. So not only meeting once a week, but also their own cell block units. They have like a little kind of family within that. And from all of them being inmates at the facility itself, they're all Coffee Creek ladies, so that they kind of all identify as part of that, even if they're new. I think it's sort of like, well, I'll be here a while. You know, some of them will be there for years, or they have been there for years. And for those folks specifically, you know, this is my home, really. This is where I am. So, and Zen, we talk about potato practice, something that Damu has said before, but it's cool, so I'll say it again. how the best way to clean potatoes prior to cooking is to put them all in a big pot full of water and shake them around. And living in community creates this cleaning process where we all potatoes get clean by bumping up against each other over and over. Or living in community can also be seen as like a rock tumbler, where a lot of rocks with sharp edges are, you know, tumble around and all the sharp edges knock together and smooth. So we all come out smooth and polished, hopefully. At Coffee Creek, I'd say it feels more like a rock tumbler. And learning how to be in community is a main aspect of these inmates, these women's lives. So as it's the difficulty of it, but also the strength they find in it. The precept of taking refuge in Sangha is something they know. And it's a fundamental part of their healing journey, I think, because to learn how to be with others in a mutually beneficial way is, you know, a lot of them say, like, I really look forward to this every week because it's the only time I get to be with you all, or you, or you, or you. Like they are there to be with Sangha, really. And I feel like some of them will bring the sense of being welcomed and of being loved into connectedness as they leave prison life and get back to the various fields of relationships on the outside. Hopefully, that's kind of the hope I have anyway for them. So, do we really need this? Oh, well, I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of introverts. And I think everybody needs it, even if you're an introvert. It's not always easy, you know. It's a lot of shifting around, like depending on what kind of community you're in. If this feels close and you're all friends and you're all getting to know each other, there's a lot of shifting around. You know, there's people coming and going, people that are dominant, people that are shy, people that are needy, people that are generous, and positive people and negative people, and as opposite in alignment as magnetic poles. You just can't put them together. There's just, there's no way. So I'm thinking about this specifically in terms of Coffee Creek. There's a lot of, yeah, there's sometimes a lot of conflict that enters the room, even if it's not happening in the room. You know that the conflict happened like right before they entered the room, and they're like, "Well, I'm in chapel now, so." And they talk about their cell blocks. That's what I was referring to earlier. Yeah, their cell block is a sangha, but it can be strife in their cell blocks. So it's pretty funny because when I think about when I. What I expected when I was going to prison for the first time, what it's really like in there. I had this idea about what prison inmates were going to be like. And now I just laugh because when I did my homework on it early in the semester, I had to write, we just have to reflect on everything in these very touchy-feely ways. Anyway, so I was reflecting on everything and I hadn't entered the prison yet. So I was like projecting, what the problems with what prisoners would be like. And I was so wrong. I was just so wrong about everything because I thought like, oh, prisoners, they're going to be tough, they're going to be dangerous, they're going to be unruly, they're going to be crazy, they're going to be sad, there's going to be all combinations of this, and they're going to be scary. And I was scared, but how wrong I was. There was, well, there's some misaligned behavior and some attitude. There's a fair amount of attitude, but there's also kindness and vulnerability. And I don't know why it should have surprised me. I don't know, but some inmates have already taken Jukai and they're wearing one of these and have obviously clocked more. And I've talked to Genko about it too. It's like, oh, they've been meditating for years. They clock more time in the kitchen than me. So what am I doing in there? Like, I don't know. It was a big dose of humility, just lots and lots of humility and just reorienting. So like, okay, here's what I'm doing here. I'm just here to be with them. I don't have anything to teach them. I'm just here to be with them, really. Let's see. What else have I got? Oh, about the Foundations and Contemplative Care program. I want to talk a little bit more about that. And just as a, out in front, I am not encouraging anyone to take this course. I'm not like, I want to remain neutral. I'm not saying, oh, go take this class, or anything like that. Or oh, don't. I really warn you against this. Like, no, neither. It's like, if you want to do this kind of work, then yeah, I guess. New York Zen Center is only unique because it's the only one that spits out like Buddhist chaplains, like real Buddhist chaplains, as opposed to a Christian chaplain. So I don't know. It's kind of unique. And it's really focused on relationships, at least the contemplative care track, and how one is in relationships, because their specialty, of course, is to train people to provide spiritually informed contemplative care to those who might be ill or dying or in some kind of distress. Some significant distress is really what it's for. So, of course, then it's important to like, you're going to go into a room, it's going to be a one-on-one encounter. So then it's down to you and me, Jen. It's just you and me. Where we are, we have to make a connection. And the term they use for it is care partnering or care partnership, as opposed to caregiving, which is a word that you hear a lot in like healthcare and stuff. Because it's about the space between us, it's not lopsided. It's not like, oh, I'm giving to you and you're just sitting there. We're establishing a true connection. And if there's a space between us, is there a wall? Is there some kind of wall that's stopping us from connecting? And so that's what we're exploring, like what stops us from being in authentic relationship with the other person. So I want to start by reading, or continue anyway, by reading. From this book, Awake at the Bedside. It's Contemplative Teachings on Palliative and End-of-Life Care. And it's edited by Koshin Paley Ellison, but it's got a lot of writers in it. And this piece is by Judy Leaf, who is a Tibetan Buddhist and chaplain. She says, connection matters, for this place of meeting is where the healing takes place. In my tradition, we talk a lot about in-between spaces. In between you and me is where the healing takes place. In between past and future is where healing takes place. In that in between, you step into raw, uncomfortable space together, and that is where the healing takes place. True healing and truly being with another person is kind of scary and vulnerable. So most of us, at least me, don't want to go there that often. Yet often we expect the other person to do so. We expect the other person to grow through the experience. And we want to watch and enjoy it from a slight distance. But how can you ask someone to go into a space that you yourself are not willing to enter? basic state we all share is that none of us are here that long. The world has gone on a long time without us, and it'll be fine when we leave. We don't have much time. We may feel blessed in many ways of health and vigor, but this life is unpredictable. It is totally unpredictable. So how can we help ourselves be able to connect at a level that is even? Can we relate in a way that is not based on higher versus lower, powerful versus unpowerful, healthy versus sick? Can we be in the same boat on a level playing field with one another? So, being on that level playing field is exactly what is meant by care partnership as opposed to caregiving. You're walking with them. Koshin, my teacher, he's got a way of looking directly at other students in class. And it's great to watch because he looks around the room. Hello, Natalie. I see you there. What a lovely yellow sweatshirt. I just, you know, and he's just like right there. Or hi, Jacob. Oh, go on. And those pants. Woo! Okay, so we're just like, he does this, but he's just so like, he's just so connected. It's a noticeable difference about him, noticeable. He's really into being like, we're in this together in each moment. He kind of enjoys it, actually. He models that and he teaches it too at the same time. You know, how to let those walls dissolve. And so you can start to invite some of that intimacy with another and really walk with another person. Okay, so this sounds easy, but it's not. And I think most people in their daily lives do not relate to others in this way, like in this super deep way, because it's sort of like what Nomiya said once about Zazen. Like, if you're doing it right in public, you look weird doing it and you feel weird doing it. And so that's how you know it's Zazen, because it's the same as connecting authentically with another person. It's definitely different. It's radical, man. So let's see. Yeah, so looking, okay. We did this exercise in class that I'll just describe because it doesn't work if you do it with people that you already know. So it's total strangers, right? Now, this is what we're working with. We're looking directly into people's eyes, and it can be difficult. It can be uncomfortable to maintain unbroken eye contact, and it feels creepy sometimes. But in class, we did this in this exercise. We do this all the time, actually, in various exercises and in small groups and in dyads and triads and all these like therapist terms, right, Tyler? Therapist terms. This isn't the first therapist term you're gonna hear from me. Okay. So, but what I call it stranger gazing. Okay. That's what I called it. There was no name for it, but I call it stranger gazing. What we did was we sit across from the other person or pin them on Zoom, and we just sit and look at them, and particularly looking at their face and into their eyes. And Koshin allowed silence for a bit, and then he did this gentle, quiet teisho over the top when we're looking into the other person's eyes. And then we're just meditatively looking at them. We're thinking about the other person, total stranger. We knew nothing, but your mind kind of forms stories, you know, as you're observing them various ways. And then just observe the space and the eye contact. And then, okay, Koshin described the process of aging and asked us to imagine the other person aging. And we sat that with that for a minute. And then he asked for us to imagine the other person passing away. And then we sat with that for a minute. And it didn't feel gruesome or sad, although you're sitting there thinking, oh my God. This sounds, but it just felt like true, like wow, like impermanence. This stuff is really hard, but the way I will remember it forever, because after 10 minutes, I cannot say I wasn't both totally in love with the stranger and teary-eyed at the feeling of losing them, and I didn't even know them. So yeah, this is kind of what this class is like. It's a lot of this kind of stuff. And I can't say it's for everybody, so. approach at your own risk. But yeah, so we've been learning how to communicate and connect in this really gentle and intimate way. And more importantly, how to listen to your care partner really deeply and get yourself out of the way, or actually reverse that. You get yourself out of the way and then you connect really deeply with your care partner because that's that wall. You have to remove it first. The more you let the ego get quiet, the more you can actually hear what the other person is saying. And you can even start perceiving what they're saying underneath their words. And then you can form that bond or address that underlying emotion or issue or relieve that person's suffering. It's not about fixing the other person's, it's about creating a true, authentic encounter with them, meeting them where they are, and bringing your presence. So, a few examples of how you can approach depending on the other person, what kind of state they're in. So, if you're aware that the other person is in distress, you can try this. And Tyler, you probably already know this. It's called co-regulation. But in class, they called it borrowing your nervous system or lending your nervous system to somebody else. So here's a good description. I'm just going to sort of tell you how it was discussed in class. Aisha is a TA, and she came into the room. She had been listening to Chodo. Robert Chodo Campbell, who is the other co-founder of the New York Zen Center, he had been giving a body scan meditation, so to relax somebody, giving an example, and we're all doing it. Okay, so she turned to Chodo and let him know she noticed something she felt during the guided meditation. When she walked into the Zendo, she felt anxious, but then sitting close to him, she admitted she hadn't listened to every word he was actually saying. But she was taking in the tone of his voice. She described that she felt like he loaned her his nervous system. She felt herself get completely calm and grounded, and her anxiety slipped away. That has been a huge learning for her that she's noticed before that we either infect people with our nervous system or loan them our nervous system. The Chodo agreed. He explained how he was consciously doing this on purpose. He said, "It's all about being very aware of your own nervous system first." And he always checks himself before entering a room that there's a lot of this terminology going into the room, like for whatever encounter you're about to have. And I'd say 80% of students are doing hospital chaplaincy as part of their internship. So I'm like the weirdo that's not doing that right now, but that's what they mean all the time. They're like, "We're going into a room, we're going to a room." And you just have to ground yourself before you go in. Because he says, if you're in a stressed relationship with your own body, you could be tense or speaking too quickly. So he recommends if you really get into your body and be grounded and maybe do some deep breathing and then into the room, then that's better for both people. The technique he explained was to notice someone's breathing. And sometimes you could either passively notice it and match it, or you can ask them. You can say, "I'd like to ask you if that's okay with you to follow my breath and breathe with me. How about we do this for a while, just for a couple minutes? We'll just breathe in together and breathe out together." And you just sit with them and you do that for a while. Those of you who are familiar with yoga know this feeling because a lot of times you're guided to breathe at the same times and you're in a room together and you're all doing it. That in itself is like a big old co-regulation package that just happens as part of yoga class. And sometimes that's, the best thing you can do in the moment with that person. It's more than 85% of all communication and body language. So you don't necessarily remember what people say, but you remember how it felt to be in their presence. So basically, your calm state influences the other person, brings them to into a calm state. And it occurred to me, like, what a perfect gift for a practicing Zen Buddhist to bring into any situation. Because this is what we're training ourselves to do, like have quiet mind, right? So then it's an act of generosity to bring your practice of equanimity and calm and being really right there in the present moment. To whatever moment you're meeting or entering the room, right? How we are inside is affects other people the most. And if you're concerned about how you are inside, then that's pretty normal. Then that shows like self-awareness. Koshin introduced us to the idea of the inner Sangha, our inner great assembly, made up of all the different parts of ourselves, our inner demigods, and our demons too. We need to be able to take refuge in that Sangha, the Sangha inside. I think this is like Dogen said, to know yourself first, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by all things. I thought of that when he said that. I'm like, yeah, okay, studying self. So, okay, this book is another one we were assigned in class. It is called Casting Interest in Fostering Spiritual Kinship and Community. And this is where I got the idea for the name of this talk, because kinship is a great word. I love it. Anyway, this is by Sister Ao. And she talks about mirroring and twinning, which are some more techniques you may use, have access to in your toolbox. And Domio actually mentioned it recently in her talk. Mirroring and twinning is, and Sister Ao talked to us live in class about this part and explained it a little bit about mirroring and twinning. And she said, no, wait, I want to make sure you know that mirroring and twinning is not about you being more of a narcissist. It's about when you're dealing with someone who is a narcissist or in a narcissistic moment, like someone who's really hard to deal with at all. Like, you probably aren't going to have a relationship with them unless you did something to try to do something about them. So she says mirroring is when someone reflects to another that they're worthy of respect. This is done through positively affirming another. Here's an example. Let's say the person caught up in their sense of grandiosity is bragging about something they did. You are irritated because you're conditioned to have an adverse reaction to braggarts. Mirroring in this situation might look like saying, I think it's great you have such a talent. Can you see how such a response is a skillful means that decreases the likelihood that the person feels the need to intensify their bragging? And twinning is a way of conveying that you share similar traits. This is the Me Too one, where you're listening to somebody and you go, oh yeah, me too, me too. Even narcissistic ones you may share with them, with the person who's immersed in grandiosity. This helps them not to feel weird or isolated in their sense of self. And importantly, this holds true even if it's a person who would never confess their vulnerability to anyone and may not be in touch with it themselves at all. They don't even know. How might one twin in this way? Express that you feel celebratory about their accomplishment because you've also experienced something similar. Mirroring and twinning relational skills help narcissists be in relationship, and those of us using mirroring and twinning, thereby using our own narcissism for good, are also helped by not alienating people who irritate us. I liked that part because I thought of an incident before in my life. I said, oh my gosh, I wish I could replay it and do that because that would have really helped. But oh well, the past is gone. I can't do that. Okay, so yeah, so when you're dealing with people who may hold really challenging political views that are different from yours, that can be really tough. It's really tempting to just push them away. You can try being loving, compassionate, present, but ultimately truthful, easily said than done. They might leave you on their own, but you can allow them to do that. And Sister Io described during class last Saturday, she has a childhood friend. They live next door and grew up together, so they're really close as kids. And in her words, he basically became a Black fascist. And she's a proud Black queer elder activist. And the two like, meh. But she's still friends with him and visits him, and they still have a thriving relationship. So why does she do that? Because her mother and his mother are still friends. So she's doing it for her mom. But also, there's this challenge, like, How does she do that? She sticks to her views, but she doesn't try to change his mind. She doesn't try to make him be any certain way to please her. She's just centered in her own, grounded in her own stuff. And somehow it works. Pretty amazing when I heard that. Anyway, so those are some ways we can begin to see each other for who we really are and meet each other in that space between. And it's pretty crazy. It's pretty radical. I love it when you're going against the stream, you're doing radical stuff, you're doing stuff that other people in the culture aren't doing. Then I get all jazzed. I get all jazzed about Zen Buddhism then. Yeah, cool. It's the radical weirdos. I love it. So why try so hard to do this? Why go off and do this crazy thing? I believe that how we are at the small scale is how we are at the larger scale. So Zen can help us moving from the micro as individuals to the macro, from the interpersonal small scale to the large scale. And I believe that our Zen practice can heal the way we relate to others in our world. So the last quote I'm going to read is from Opening to Oneness on page 180. This will be familiar to many of you because we've used it in precepts already. Opening to Oneness by Nancy Mujo Baker. Okay, what would oneness with others be like? Bernie Glassman used to demonstrate oneness in the realm of manyness by imagining the absurdity of my right hand hesitating to put out the flames burning my left hand, or my right hand stealing or refraining from stealing from my left hand as my left hand reaches for money being handed to it. It makes no sense. On the news, when we see human beings rushing to the aid of other human beings, as well as rescuing animals, we are often deeply moved. This kind of reaction from the outside makes sense, but those rushing to the aid of others are often simply experiencing what is meant by natural and spontaneous expression of the precepts. They're no longer moral principles separate from us. They are, in a sense, our very being. And so are other people, dogs, cats, cows, and trees. Others, then, are like my left hand, and I am like my right hand, automatically, spontaneously putting out the fire. All of reality is in one body. All of reality is one body. I love that so much. And I went, oh, I have to read that. And to me, this can mean and all beings, including the more than human beings that share Earth with us, are part of this Earth Sangha. I like to think of our relatedness to all forms of life and that relatedness into oneness, to wholeness, our capacity to wake up is greater because of this wholeness. So recently, those of you who attend Sunday services may have noticed someone new on the merit list. This someone is Hope the humpback whale, a young whale that washed up on the shore of the Oregon coast, not too far from here. I don't know, I guess it's about an hour west of here. And some of you locals may have followed the story of this beached but living whale that held on for a few days, which was unusual because usually when they wash up, they are already passed away. He held on for a few days while the capital M mobilization of all kinds of people were rushing to his aid. Internet was abuzz with talk of what to do, what should be done, what caused the whale to become stuck in the first place, what caused the whale to become sick in the first place, on and on and on, back and forth. He did pass away on the third day, and that's when I added him to the merit list. But what I kept in my heart from witnessing that was so many people cared for this whale. And if people caring for a sick loved one is where Kanzeon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, shows up, then she sure showed up, shining in full splendor on that beach. And I just imagine her feet in the sand and her robes just draping into the water. And anyway, that was me adding hope to the list. This is excerpt from the article by Rachel Donald from Planet Critical. And a link to that is in the chat so you can read the whole thing. She says, there is a future in which we know the world and love it for what it is, a world in which the mass grave of any species causes us to drop to our knees, a world in which our brothers and sisters are the folk with whom we share space, not genes. Such a world is not brought about by self-care, spontaneous enlightenment, or sitting still for hours each day. It's brought about by study. And by moving the body and living what we learn so we can know it truly. And so here we go. Really knowing the other being or beings and seeing them for what they really are. And then loving what is revealed to us. It is brought about by living with, by sharing with, and by opening to. We already live in a world in which we're perfectly capable of forgetting where our own limbs end and another's begins. This is the embodiment of our entangled world. For a bright future, the best we can do with ourselves is get tangled up in one another and all. And when I read that, I thought, well, this is how Zen Buddhism can help the future. I think about that sometimes. Our survival actually depends on this kind of activity, our ability to be together and to walk with each other. I believe it is and will be waking up to and embodying this way of radical kinship, truly taking refuge in and becoming one Sangha. So that is me. And now it's you. Speaking of spaces in between and meeting with you. Okay. It's 8:42. I'm sorry I went a little over. I something I was kind of curious about, in case you're thinking, what do I ask about? Is how you've personally experienced the phenomenon of Sangha, what you feel like was a Sangha you ran into that might not have been here. Something outside of here. Or just, ask me anything about the prison program or about the New York Zen Center, anything like that. So I forgot how to take questions. I have no idea. Nobody's
Should raise their hand.
Yeah, raise your hand, please. Or come on. Come on down, Jacob. Oh, and then Jinryu.
Oh, hi, I'm Jacob. What do I do? Do I just, yeah.
I think looking there is
Yeah.
looking at them.
Hi, everybody.
No,
It's
I
my second time. Okay, we're gonna, okay. So, last time I mentioned a Ram Dass quote, and I believe it was Natalie. We are a part of the Ram Dass Satsang, and every time I turn on a lecture, there's always an introduction, and I was like, you are a part of the Ram Dass Satsang. And a lot of people,
Sangha.
and like Ram Dass, Alan Watts, like just wisdom teachers, what, Dogen, right? Like you could think of just like people that like if we share a teacher, we're part of the same kind of sangha in a way, in a way, like a spread out, because we don't always meet up and talk with everybody who's ever listened to a certain teacher, but it's just something I thought of. So
Yeah, no, that's totally true. And especially post COVID, having the feeling of Sangha remotely is so much stronger now. So it's a real thing.
that's the only time I've gotten into sangha. It wasn't after COVID, but
Yeah.
yeah. Anyway,
Yes.
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. Jinryu.
Thank you for this very inspirational talk. I'm going to have to listen to it again. I have two questions. One is a little bit personal, so if you don't feel like answering it, it's fine. I feel like I could sit here and ask you five or six questions, but I'll just limit it to two for now.
Time ago.
My first question is, if you could share with us, what is your goal, if you have one? What are you aiming to do with this course that you're taking?
That's a $6 million question for
Okay,
sure.
that's fine.
You win. No. It's funny because I it's the process that interests me. I knew that when I went to the orientation, it was going to be something big. I don't know where the end goal is, but I know the path is really interesting. And it's helping me out a lot as a person.
It sounds like it is, and thank you for that. My other question is related to mirroring and twinning. I wasn't familiar with the term twinning. I was familiar with the term mirroring, but I'm not sure what you described is the way I remember what mirroring is. But when I have in the past done what I thought I heard you describing, it felt like it didn't feel healthy. It felt like enabling, felt like flattery, kind of flattery. You talk a little about that?
I mean, that exact question came up in class this past Saturday. And I was thinking of not including mirroring and twinning in this talk. But then Demio said, "Oh no, keep them in there." Because I've just scratched the surface and I just kind of want to know more anyway. So she and I are asking the same questions of each other about what is this? Like, why would you do this? But Sister Ayo in class addressed somebody asking exactly that. Like, isn't this more ego? Aren't you just boosting them up or you up or but I think what I got out of her explanation is it's to use when somebody is so self-absorbed that you need to open that. You know how I was saying there's a channel, there's a space between, we've dug it out, we've dug it out, we've dug it out, but there's a wall there. And so we're getting rid of that wall. And in the case of somebody who's that close, that's someone who's just that into themselves, they don't even know anything you're doing, just to get them to acknowledge you and look at you and start listening, actually, that connection can start to form a little. So that's what mirroring and twinning are really aimed for. Not for everybody, but just in those difficult relationships that might not exist anyway. Does that make sense?
Me, but I guess.
Okay, she's quiet. I assume that means she got it. Oh yeah, I had somebody once where it's like, oh, if I had just done this, if I had just been quiet and listened and perceived that they were in a narcissistic space and then done some of these things, it's like, I don't know. Would we have been able to chip away at it? I don't know. But it would have been a better chance, I think. I think. So, anybody else? I hear a sound somewhere. AJ, my dude, are you there? We're being radical. I thought you might enjoy it. Going against the stream, AJ.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Great talk, Leah. I love it.
Okay. Good. I was thinking of you when I was writing that. Okay, Charles. Awesome. Hi.
Hey, I really appreciated your talk, and it's always cool to like listen to other minds and new ideas, new perspectives. One thing that I like really, I don't know if you exactly said this or if it's kind of like what I thought you said or like was inspired by something that you said, but like lending your body, your nervous system to somebody else, like, there's a lot like You can feel like you're not being productive enough as like a member of society, that you're not like doing enough out there. And it just made me think of like, if every human interaction you could like lend your nervous system to whoever you're interacting with, like over a lifetime, like I can't imagine being more productive than that in any like anything else that you could do that would be more beneficial to, you know, your left hand than that. But yeah,
Yeah.
I appreciate the talk. Thanks.
That's so true. Oh my gosh, that's so true. Yeah, and it's against the grain of what usually your brain tells you to do. Yeah, your brain tells you, I gotta say something, I gotta do something, I gotta fix. But this is like a very Zen Buddhist moment of like the not doing and the just being with is actually more effective. So
Yeah, it makes me think of the laying in the snow koan.
the laying in the snow koan.
Yeah, where there's like somebody outside of the monastery stuck in the snow, and he's, you know, crying out to one of the monks, or I can't remember who it was in this koan, and instead of trying to help the person out of the snow, they just jumped into the snow next to him, be with them.
Oh, I love that. I'm not sure how practical that is, but I love it. I have to go on. That is so good. Oh my gosh. Thank you, Charles. Thank you. Hey, Ray.
Can you hear me?
I can. Little soft.
Okay. How about, is this
Yes.
better?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I'm on my phone and I'm learning how this works. So I feel like what was it Charles? Sorry, I
Charles
can't see
just
him.
spoke. Yes,
Okay,
about.
yeah. I think what Charles just said kind of spoke to what I was thinking about the twinning and about how, I don't know, I'm just kind of flying by the seat of my pants, but that it can kind of be about like meeting somebody where they're at, you know,
Yeah.
which is similar to that koan and kind of what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, that's true. Like I said, I gotta go find that koan because it's so meeting somebody where they're at, even if that place they're at might not be the greatest place. Like if you're meeting them in the middle, you're walking with them instead of ahead or behind, or you know, you're getting in there with them. That's what we've been talking about a lot at the New York Zen Center is somebody's in a pit and they need you to come down there and be with them in the pit. And then also how to make sure you don't get stuck in the pit yourself and that you have a rope, but you can bring yourself down, you can bring things down, you can be with them for a while in there, wherever they are. Thank you, Ray. Few more minutes. Hey, Jen.
Okay, I hope I'm not gonna get off track, but when you were talking about like other groups that could be sanghas, I was thinking of something you're familiar with, which is the co-op gallery.
Oh yeah, galleries.
And I was in one of those before I came here, and I look at it as like a giant failure, you know. I'm trying not to think of it as a personal failure, but I always thought like, oh, I understand this person, I understand that person, they don't understand each other, but I can try to help the communication, and it didn't work. And maybe because I don't have training, maybe if I had training that would have worked better. But why I feel like this group works is we all agreed on what our like on some basic rules. And so like what do you have any advice for it? Well, I mean, because you've been talking about groups where maybe people don't have all the same values and like literally don't have the same idea of how you should behave, you know, towards another person, or like what is the way to be it? Like if someone wrongs you, what is the right thing to do about it? You know, it's just I had my eyes really open to how many different value systems there could be. I guess like you just figure, oh, we're all artists, maybe we're all on the same page, but
Oh my gosh, no.
we were not.
That is not the
Yeah.
case.
And like so anyway, I'm glad I don't need to deal with that anymore. So I wondered if you had any thoughts on how to exist in a group where there are no rules or agreed upon standards.
Oh, well. I've been in a lot of different these weird little activist spaces and kind of nonprofit spaces, and sometimes there are rules, a set of guidelines, expectations. Sometimes those are documented. That's a great idea. That's a really good idea.
But no, somebody has to enforce
I
those.
know, I know. I'm about to say it's a great idea. But I think that's what makes Bright Way Zen so special, is because it's not just an idea. Like, we're really sitting here and we're working on ourselves, and we're working on getting our egos out of the way, you know, so we really can be in relationship, and or at least have enough self-awareness to just stop, you know, and just, you know, wait a minute, what am I doing here? Like, I've not been perfect here, and nobody's expected to be perfect here, but I'd say Bright Way Zen is like 10 million times more perfect than having to deal with, you know, like some people might say, oh, well, maybe my people at work, you know, in my department, maybe we're a sangha. And I'm like, okay, well, you could be, but I'm sort of exploring the difference. It's like, well, maybe you're not, because if you go there and it's just like you're at work and you all do politics and kind of hate each other and bicker and compete and da 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 and all that stuff, and your egos are all, you know, like that. And it's like, eh, no, I don't know if that qualifies as sangha environment. So the only thing I can say is that because I've been in all these spaces, and I don't think a lot of them have been that successful, not all of them have had very much longevity. That's a problem, because things fall apart at some point. From interpersonal clashes and stresses, it's always somebody or somebody's like doing some crazy thing, and it blows up and falls apart. And that's happened so often that it's like, well, I have new hope, honestly, for the first time in my life.
Because of the class, the
Well,
course you're taking.
because
Oh,
here,
because of here. Yeah, it makes a big
it
difference.
makes a big difference.
Yeah.
It's so different. And then also, you know, the class is like, oh, now I see how I could have handled things, or how someone else can handle things. But the only thing you can bring to it is yourself in any context, in any room. You're just bringing yourself. So hopefully, the more you've thought about it, the more I've thought about it, the more we've explored it, then the stronger we'll be, and the better the outcome will be. So.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk.
Thank you. Thank you for asking a question, because we're at 8:59. Perfect, perfect. So, thank you for coming. I want to say that for sure, because I know it was pouring rain tonight. So, we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha. Prajna Paramita.
Thank you so
Thank you.
much.
I love you guys. I always make this sign because I love you. Yay.
Love you too.
I love you.
Bye. It was
Bye.
really good.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks, Leah. I was there, just my connection was crappy, so I was keeping my window off so I could keep
Oh.
the for the video recording as best I could. So
Oh,
it's not
good.
letting, yeah.
Okay.
But I was there. I really appreciate the talk. It was lovely.
Thank
Oh,
you, Tyler,
now I need to
for
stop
all your
recording. Oh, God.